This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers.
How's it going?
Hey, not bad. How are you?
We are, it's a little crazy around here. So, like, some personal news of mine, as I told you before the show went on, my wife and I were scheduled to take a trip to St. Thomas later on this fall. And obviously, due to Hurricane Irma, that is not going to be happening. And so we are trying to rearrange flights and go to a different location. We're celebrating a pretty big anniversary this year. And so, yeah, it's just been crazy, all these travel plans. Obviously, these are like minor problems compared to people that have actually had their homes destroyed and will be destroyed. I'm going to get some decent amount of rain from the hurricane, but nothing. That'll be basically it. The one of the great things to me about living in Chattanooga is we have enough mountains where we don't have a lot of tornadoes. We've had some, but then we obviously are too far inland to see any major damage from hurricanes. So we're kind of and obviously like earthquakes aren't a big problem here. So we are kind of shielded from a lot of the natural disasters. So, but I know definitely, I think about like the schools in those areas. That's just tough to deal with. They just have, it's like mind-boggling. I mean, obviously, the devastation of lives and properties is certainly worse. But then you start thinking about having to rebuild your school. And we were almost in that boat back in 2011. We were out without power for 5 days, and that's when my kind of cloud first strategy really paid off, because we were able to still do things like process payroll, because as long as we had an internet connection somewhere, we could access all that. So so our thoughts and prayers are those suffering from Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Irma.
Absolutely. Yeah, so after that, on to trivialities, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Before we get started tonight, I want to thank some Patreons that have supported the show. We have a Patreon page at outofschool.net, and so we have some people that donate to the show monthly just to help us pay for the hosting and buy microphones and buy us coffee and things like that. So we have a thing called the Dean's List that we list on our website. Anybody supports us with a $3 or more a month donation, we list them there. And then we also have the a couple people that do $10 or more a month, and we like to give them a shout out on the show just as a thank you. So that's Michael Slade, Envision Design LLC, Nicholas Colfarrell, and Justin McGrath. So thanks to those folks for sponsoring us on Patreon. If you want to throw a dollar to our way, we'd appreciate it. Check us out at outofschool.net.
Awesome. So as you know, Bradley, when the start of term comes around, the most important thing for any teacher to do is to start a massive new home project at the same time. And I thought we would maybe talk a little bit about that today. I had a project to kind of replace my Plex server at home. And you might wonder, like, why are we talking about, home servers and things like that? But I think Plex is something that maybe actually has more application to education than people think it does. So I thought we might talk about the reasons in the process and some of the issues that I ran into trying to restore that server that broke down, and maybe we'll motivate some people to look into Plex for schools as well.
So we're talking about, like, what is Plex? This is something a lot of people talk about, and it has many applications. We actually used to use it here for our display signage. So, and this is all a timely discussion about backup and restoring, because CrashPlan has recently announced they're getting out of the consumer backup game, and a lot of people are talking about, like, what are the best options out there, there's just various caveats, and we won't discuss that today, but it's just kind of all along that discussion. So at its core, Plex is a media center application. It's really has its roots in the old Xbox Media Center days, and Fraser, can you tell me the game that was kind of the front point to getting Xbox Media Center installed on an Xbox One back in the day? Do you have any idea?
I have no clue.
So, okay, I'm going off memory here. But from what I remember, Splinter Cell was the game that somehow, like, a memory card hack, I don't know, like, you loaded some memory card save on somehow from the internet, and, like, that was... That basically opened you up to being able to kind of like hack your Xbox. And Plex evolved out of that over like a decade. And Plex is really fantastic. So Plex is a free application that runs on just about everything. And like on the Mac, for example, it's a menu bar application and you point it at folders on your Mac. And so like in my Plex server at home, you can run it like on a Mac Mini, like an old laptop, really anything. I have four quote-unquote servers inside of my Plex. So there's kids movies, kids TV shows, movies and TV shows, obviously, like those are the grown-up shows. And what Plex does is it watches those folders and it can add those files to a really nice front end that pulls in the metadata, the artwork, and all of the information from like the TV database and the moviedatabase.com. And you just builds a nice front end. Like you don't have to manage the files. It just handles it on its own and it builds basically a web server. And then you can access that content from iOS, from Android, from Apple TV, from Roku. Like they have apps for everything. And they're really quite nice. And then you can like download stuff offline. So it's basically like, you know, what iTunes Match in some ways is for music. This is that for like music and TV shows, although it does work with music and photos as well. Yeah. And the great thing is like you can on the apps, you can download the content offline and then you can access it from anywhere. And then it is a free service. They do have like paid options that allow you to get extra features like being able to download content. There's a monthly fee option. Then they have a lifetime option, which I believe is $150. That used to be like $75 years ago. And I did that, gosh, back in like 2014. So I've paid for that many times over. And my thing is too, even if you don't use all the features of the premium packages, if you do use the application, I would recommend, you know, at least throwing them some money here and there for a premium subscription. Now, and this is different than like, say, iTunes Match, where you're not uploading your data to Plex. Like there is no hosted Plex that they host for you. You are basically hosting the data either like on your own server. At home, when I say server, I don't mean like a big Dell server. I mean like a computer that's online. Yeah. And there are multiple ways to do that. We'll work through. But that's just kind of a brief rundown of what Plex is. Mm-hmm. Some people love Plex. Some people like it's just overkill. My thing is like, because you can add all this stuff to iTunes and access it like on your Apple TV as long as the Mac's on the network. But iTunes gets very cumbersome over time. And this is just like a dead simple way to access it. Now, you may be asking, like, what is the way to get content into Plex? Well, you can't like buy music or movies from iTunes or Amazon and load them into Plex because they have DRM. So you have to rip your own stuff. You find it on the back of a truck somewhere, that kind of stuff. Most of the people like
home
they'll
movies.
Rip
home movies.
Yes, yeah, all about your home movies with your kids. Yeah. Most people like you know they'll rip Blu-rays or they'll rip DVDs right into Plex or they'll rip their TV shows right into Plex. And I can understand what the episodes are. It's really quite remarkable, in my opinion. So that's kind of a brief rundown of what Plex is. Fraser, what are some use cases for schools? Obviously, this is more of like a personal diary episode where you're talking about something you're doing in your house. But like, what are some use cases in schools that you can think of?
Well, I think it's something that's kind of, I keep getting this question more and more as teachers move more towards iOS. It's like, I've got this DVD from, some educational charity, or I've got this DVD from a pack of resources that we bought 10 years ago that we still use. You know, it goes along with textbooks or something. And I think one of the subjects in the secondary school that actually this is a big issue for is French, because often they have like audio CDs and DVDs that go along with their textbook materials, but also English as well, where sometimes watching a film adaptation of a play or something is something we want to do. And less we've got DVD players lying about in the school, and more people are on iOS. So it's not something I've ever done in our school, but it's something I'm kind of thinking about is, you know, do we just, you know, find all the resources that we have on optical discs and just rip them all and fire up a Plex server in the school and just make it accessible for whoever wants to use it. I think that's something that's it's probably at this point a project that might be worth considering, because we do have a license. I don't know if you guys have like these school licenses for showing videos and movies and stuff like that. We have one called the Motion Picture Licensing something, MPLC it's called, and that means that if we want to show a DVD, in the school, we can do that, you know. I don't know what the legal position is relative to like ripping that DVD and serving it up digitally. I'm not sure, but I'd probably have to look into that before we actually did that project. But I think that's a pretty strong way to start thinking about Plex in school.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, like we've used this for our digital display signage. I mean, there's a lot of the ways you can kind of bend it to your will. So tell us about your old Plex server.
Yeah, so I've had this Plex server for quite a few years now. Since actually, it was you that got me into it, Bradley. You were saying, like, you know, just go and buy this lifetime pass and don't think about it. You know, you'll thank me later. And here I am thanking you all these years later because it's worked really well for us over a lot of years. What I had was I was running Plex. I had a 2011, I think it is, Mac Mini. It was the last aluminium Mac Mini with the built-in DVD drive, which no longer works, I might add, but that's the model that it was. And it was running Plex. I think that machine is a Core 2 Duo, right? So it's pretty aged. And if you're looking at a machine that you want to be sort of serving up video and transcoding video files and stuff, that might not be the one you're thinking of. It's worked pretty well for us, but obviously those machines didn't have very big hard drives, so all, hanging off the back of that for years has been a 3 terabyte Western Digital drive. And fortunately, thankfully, the machine was fully backblazed, you know, so as I kind of moved to iOS from a Mac for my personal use, I moved my backblaze license onto that machine, and all the data, like the terabyte and a half, I think, of video content that I had on there was all on backblaze, thank goodness, because what happened was the disk started to go bad, and it was the disk, it was the external disk that had had all my stuff on it. So I suppose in a way you could say, like, well, you know, 24/7 operation, consumer grade external hard drive, that's probably not going to last more than a few years. And honestly, it didn't last more than a few years. So, but the big problem really is that I didn't take action soon enough. And I'll sort of let the disk lie there and slowly fail on me. And the signs got more and more ominous and I didn't really do enough with it. And eventually the disk just simply wouldn't work. You know, I took it off, connected it to another machine, even took it out of the enclosure, put it in a Mac Pro that we have at school, tried that, still nothing. So it was a kind of recovery situation I was in at this point. And the way I decided to do that was to kind of scrap this whole scene and set up a new Plex server somehow with a restore of my data as well. So we'll talk about the restore later on because that's a whole other story. But first of all, I had to decide what I was going to do to build a new Plex server in the house. What was I going to do? There are a lot of options and various people have done various things, but I'll tell you which one I chose, but we can talk about some of the other options as well, Bradley, if you like.
Yeah, so one of the most, I guess, sexy options that you think about now is like, okay, I don't want to run something on site. Are there cloud options? And there are cloud options through a platform called Plex Cloud. So again, Plex is not hosting this, but they can connect to like Dropbox, Google Drive, or OneDrive, and then you can stream things through that. Now, I have tried this multiple times, and I've tried it with Dropbox and Google Drive, and it's, to me, really slow. Obviously, uploading is going to be very difficult. It's going to take a lot of time, depending on the size of your collection. But like I was trying to play, I mean, like a 300 megabyte episode of a TV show, and it like took 15 to 20 seconds to load, which that doesn't sound like a lot, but like on the local server, it was taking like 2 seconds. And so I don't know. I mean, and it's like, I think it's still technically in beta, and I tried it on Dropbox when it was like very early on. And I tried it recently on Google Drive, and it was kind of the same thing. I mean, it seems like it takes forever to scan all your metadata. And I don't know if this is like how it's going to be long term, or if it's like just still, I don't know, in beta. We'll have to see. But again, I just didn't have good experiences with it, especially compared to, I mean, and again, I think it probably a lot of it is like, I have something on site that I can use. I have an old laptop that I use. And so I guess in having that, I want to use it. But like if I didn't have that, maybe I would make it just work. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think Plex Cloud is a good way to kind of get started with Plex if you don't have very much media and you're not really sure about Plex. Because you can always upgrade, right? You can have multiple Plex servers on your account. You know, you can have your Plex Cloud and you can have a local server. So if you ever wanted to, you know, upgrade to something on your own premises, you could do that, set it up, and then just start migrating the files over time, and then you just cut over to your own server. So it's not impossible to move from Plex Cloud to something hosted if you want to. But yeah, Plex Cloud, I was a little bit hesitant. I mean, we've got unlimited Google Drive at school, and I was kind of like, should I not? You know, I was like, I haven't actually read the terms of service all that closely on Google Drive, and I didn't want to like get the school account shut down for abuse or something if I suddenly drop another terabyte. I've actually already got more than a terabyte on Google Drive at school, but that's legit schoolwork. If I was to drop another terabyte of consumer media on our school Google Drive, I wasn't sure how that was going to fly. But I think the other big showstopper for me, the reason that Plex Cloud has never really been an option for me, is that we in our family we use offline syncing to devices a lot. I use it a lot for traveling, and this is a feature whereby you can, like, on the Plex iOS app, for example, you can say, like, download this movie or download this series of TV shows or whatever, and it will recompress them at a rate, it will transcode them at a rate that's suitable for your device. You can specify quality low if you want to save space, for example, and then save offline for use. And I use this all the time when I'm traveling. You know, I'll grab, you know, a season of The West Wing or 30 Rock or something and just watch that on the plane, you know. And the difficulty with Plex Cloud is it does not support offline syncing. So like you said, Bradley, it's like it's still in beta. It's a very early version. So that for me, that's a showstopper, right? Because, the kids have got Plex accounts on the back of my account, and I use it so much myself that I didn't want to give that up. So it had to be something sort of self-hosted. So that was, it's an interesting option for beginners, but I don't think, you know, for me with terabyte and a half of stuff and also some quite demanding needs, it wasn't going to work. So left that one to the side. The next thing I looked at, and the next thing that's possible, is you can put it on a NAS server. So a NAS server, for people who don't know, is short for network attached storage. So basically it's a bunch of disks with a controller attached to it, and then that's all on your network, and it acts as various kinds of servers. Quite often what they can do is it's usually like bring your own disk kind of thing. So you put in the hard drives you want, the computer that's built into that box will format them, maybe make them a RAID array or something, and then you plug it into your network and you can find it. It'll expose various services to your network. So it might offer like an SMB share or an SFTP interface or something like that. And what's really good about that is it lets you have like redundancy. So you can put multiple hard drives in it and you can have one mirroring to the other and things like that. And that all works pretty well. And some of these machines, the point is there's a little computer inside the box of disks, and some of those little computers can run Plex, right, or the server component of Plex at least. And what that lets you do is you can install Plex on your NAS. You just get one box, all the storage and the server all in one unit, and you just bang it on your network. And the theory at least is that it's going to just work like that. You can mount the disk on your Mac or whatever and copy your files over, and you should be in business. The difficulty with a NAS server, though, is that, first of all, the computer that's in that box is not often a very powerful computer. And if you're talking about doing things like transcoding video from mobile devices, streaming high-def video, maybe multiple streams over your network, some of those can be a little bit choppy in terms of their performance. And there's a very detailed compatibility list on the Plex website as to which NAS boxes work A, well, and B, at all. And you have to be very, you know, you're matching up like every digit of a serial number or a model number to make sure that you get the NAS box that is going to work for you. So that's, to me, that's the kind of, it's very marginal that those things can actually run Plex at an acceptable quality, right? Maybe if it's just you and you've got all your stuff pre-encoded and you don't need to transcode, yeah, maybe that could work. But if you've got like a family and the kids might be streaming it on the Apple TV and you want to download and transcode a bunch of stuff on your iPad before you fly tomorrow, I'm not saying that's been my experience, but that's exactly what happens all the time in my house. You're going to want something a little bit beefier than that. So some of those NAS boxes are super powerful, but the powerful ones tend to be really expensive. And the ones that you maybe want to spend that kind of money on, they tend to be much more marginal in terms of their performance and applicability for Plex.
And one thing to kind of consider here as a devil's advocate is when you think about like how much money you're going to spend on a Plex server, think about like how much data you have, how you expect it to grow in the future, and is it just cheaper to buy this stuff on iTunes?
Yeah.
I mean, like if you wouldn't make sense to buy like a $1,000 Plex server for content that you can pay $250 to buy, like just rebuy, like if you have the DVDs. I mean, so that is a consideration. Because it is something else in your house to manage. It's something else that you need to figure out how to back up, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, just kind of run that math in your head. Obviously, like if you've got thousands of dollars worth of DVDs, and you can spend $700 on a Plex server, yeah, that might make sense.
Yeah, I mean the way I came to it, Bradley, was like we had all these DVDs. We were moving away from having a DVD player in the house. In fact, we used to just the kids used to watch DVDs on an old iMac that we had, and the DVD player broke. So I was like, well, what am I going to do now? So we ended up sort of starting to migrate the kids' DVDs over to Plex. And it's a way that, you know, if I buy it off iTunes, I can watch it on my Apple ID and that's fine. But that's not so great if the family want to watch it or we're on holiday and we want some movies on April's iPad and some on Beth's iPad and a couple on George's iPad. That starts to become a much more difficult proposition. Whereas with Plex, if everything's just in Plex, it's dead easy to get that done.
So after NAS, there's some things like the Netgear Nighthawk and the NVIDIA Shield. What are those?
Well, these are the Nighthawk, the Netgear Nighthawk is a Wi-Fi router, which now it's a Wi-Fi router kind of unlike many you've ever seen. First of all, it looks like a stealth helicopter, hence the name, and it's huge and black, and it has like blue lights and antennas all over it. It looks like some kind of alien insect landed in your house. But it has a sufficiently powerful processor to run Plex. There's still a question mark over its performance in transcoding, but as a basic Plex server, it can run, and you can plug a USB drive into the router, and you can run Plex that way. The thing about the Nighthawk is it's over $400. It's actually more money than I spent on the solution I'm going to tell you about in a little second. And the NVIDIA Shield is like a kind of set-top gaming console. I think it's an Android-based gaming console, which is about $200. But again, it has, I think it's ARM-based, and it has questions over its performance in transcoding. So again, you know, price versus performance is the trade-off you're going to make here. And it's supposed to a certain level, convenience and also the skills required in order to set up, maintain, and sysadmin, whatever your solution you're going to go for.
Yeah, I mean, again, all these things roll back to like what's your level of complexity and what are you comfortable with? Like if you just want the dead simple solution that may cost you a little bit more, or maybe you may have to sacrifice performance in the long run.
So what I ended up doing, Bradley, was getting a new computer, basically, to run Plex. And I suppose if I was thinking about it from a school point of view, this would be what I would be doing, right? I would be looking at spending £200-£400 on a computer. It doesn't have to be an amazing computer, but I'm thinking rather than a lot of the things we've talked about before, like Plex Cloud or the routers or the NAS boxes or whatever, those are great for home use, I would say. Well, not great. They might even not be that good for home use, but certainly for individual use, I think they're okay. But for anything where you might have multiple users, I really think you're going to want to look at a gigabit Ethernet, PC, Mac, Linux computer running that, because the Plex server runs on all of those things. So the main advantage to using a computer is that, of course, it's got the most CPU power for doing video transcoding. Possibly has the most expensive upfront costs, right? You're going to go out and buy a computer. But actually, I managed to buy this computer for less than the Netgear Nighthawk might have cost me. I think possibly the PC or the Mac version is actually easier to administer than something like a NAS box. I think NAS boxes they seem dead simple on the face of them, but everybody I know who's ever got one has been like, oh, it's quite complicated. You've got to know about this and you've got to know about that. And, you know, people are having to become like amateur sysadmins just to run those things. One of the downsides to running a PC or a Mac is you got to run it 24/7 if you want 24/7 access to your Plex server. And obviously that's true of the others as well, but a NAS box or a router, you tend to run those 24/7 anyway, whereas a Mac or a PC, you might think about shutting it down from time to time. So you're looking at that as well as something to bear in mind. And I think that was partly what did for me, Bradley, was the fact that I was running this Mac Mini and this consumer grade hard drive basically 24/7, and I just kind of ran out of their lifespan a wee bit quickly. So yeah, that's the main thing. And I think the other thing I would say is that Plex is not one of these servers that sort of loves old hardware. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not the best thing to do to repurpose a really old machine for Plex, because you are looking for a certain level of performance just to get that transcoding and stuff done as well.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot depends on what files you have as well. So, like, if you have, yeah. I mean, you know, when we say transcoding, it means, like, let's say you have an AVI file. Plex can read that and then convert it on the fly to something that whatever device needs, whether it be MPEG-4, et cetera. So it's one of those things, if you have a lower powered machine, you'd be better off to take the time to use a program like Handbrake to convert all your content into like a native format for iPad or Apple TV.
Yeah. Yeah, Plex is very keen to transcode things. It really likes to do it. It tries to, like, there's a strong emphasis on sending the most appropriate bitstream to the device that you're coming in from. And sometimes I would say they're maybe a little overeager to do that. You know, I mean, most of my content is QuickTime or MP4 or whatever, and it still seems to want to transcode quite a lot of stuff, maybe more than I would have sort of expected it to do. So that's just something to kind of be aware of. And of course, the other issue, Bradley, with a PC or a Mac-based system is you got to manage your own backups, you know. And these backups are not small backups. You know, you're talking about, you know, if you build up a collection of TV shows and movies and so on, you're talking about terabytes of backup. And, you know, I did a sort of fit and forget Backblaze installation on my old server. And that was great because it just ran 24/7. So it didn't matter to me that it took like 40 days and nights for my first backup to complete because, well, it was just running in the background anyway. Because I don't have capped internet as well, which is great. But, you know, bear that in mind as you go through this. You are going to have to manage your own backups as well.
Before we get on to your actual decision, let's thank our sponsor for tonight. Thanks to the folks at Jamf and Jamf Pro for sponsoring this episode of Out of School. Jamf is the best solution for deploying, managing, and securing Apple devices. Over 3 million students are using and empowered by Jamf every day. Bring learning to a whole new level for your students and for your teachers by providing the tools they need to be successful in today's classroom environment. Start a free trial of Jamf at jamf.com. Again, thanks to Jamf and Jamf Pro for sponsoring Out of School this week.
All right, so you want to know what I was doing, what I decided to do at the end.
Yes.
Yep. So I went with self-hosted again. But this time, I'm moving over to Linux, okay? Now, I've been using Linux for years and years and years, and I'm pretty comfortable with administering a Linux machine. I'm aware that that's not something that everybody who's listening is going to be, you know, able or comfortable doing, but for me, it was kind of the right choice because I knew what I wanted to do and I knew what I was able to do as well. It was somebody on Twitter, I can't remember, said to me, oh, I'm thinking about replacing my Plex server and I'm probably going to get an HP Gen 8. I was like, whoa, what's an HP Gen 8 when it's at home? So I looked it up and it turned out to be this, it's what they call a micro server. So it's if you imagine like a cube, kind of like a PowerMac G4 cube, but more kind of servery and businessy looking. It's kind of it's all metal and bigger than the G4 cube as well. So it's about, I would say it's about 20 centimeters on any side, cube shape, little server. And it's an Intel-based computer designed for the sort of small and medium enterprise market, you know, kind of the office that's getting its first file server or something. This is the kind of machine that they might buy and set up. And I was crazy impressed with how much this thing had on it for the price. So I'll tell you the price first and then I'll tell you what it had on it because you'll be impressed. It was £190. From Amazon, and that was that's the base price. That's the price without any storage. Okay, so obviously CPU, the full case. It's not like a kit or anything. It comes assembled, right? It just doesn't have any drives. And the one that I got had a 2.3 gigahertz Celeron CPU. Now, how do we look up of the actual performance of that CPU, since that's an issue we're talking about here? And on Geekbench, it comes out as 4,282 Geekbench points. So it's not a crazy fast Intel CPU, but by comparison, the iPad Pro is 3,850. So it's only just a little bit faster than my iPad Pro. But compared to my previous Plex server, the Core 2 Duo Mini, which is 2,600 points, so it's nearly double what my previous Plex server was. So I'm already noticing quite a performance boost when I'm trying to do things like downloading, caching shows offline, and so on. So I was pretty impressed with that. Celeron-based machine, 4 gigs of RAM, you can put 8 in it if you want to, 6 USB ports, dual Ethernet on the back, VGA output. It's got a RAID controller in it as well, and a lights out management module, all built in. There are 4 drive bays on the front, 4 empty drive bays. They're not hot swappable, but they are replaceable without tools, which is great. And all of that for less than £200. It's pretty great.
Yeah, that is a good deal.
Yeah, there are other models, right? So if you look up the HP website, there's at least 3 different models, and I think you can actually go up to a Core i5 on that machine. So, but that's more like £600, you know, which is what more than I wanted to spend. So, if you have kind of basic home needs, yeah, that's a pretty good machine. If I was building it for a school, I might think about spending the extra to get a more powerful CPU in it. But for me, it didn't feel necessary. And of course, like I said, it was already double what I was living with at that time. So it's a big improvement, yeah. And what I also did was I added a 3 terabyte drive to that as well. So Western Digital make these RED drives, which are quote-unquote NAS rated. They're designed to be run 24/7 in a NAS box. So that was like another £100 to put 3 terabytes of storage in it as well. I mean, 3 terabytes of storage, that's crazy. So the whole solution under £300. And I think that might be, you know, some of the cheapest on-premise hardware that you could get to run Plex. I mean, we've talked about those NAS boxes, and some of them cost much more than that. And the Nighthawk X10 costs more than that. It's comparable to the NVIDIA Shield, which is considered maybe one of the weaker ways of using Plex. So, yeah, I was really impressed.
Yeah, that's that is kind of a good. I mean, as long as you're willing to kind of go through the process of setting up, that's a great value.
Yeah, it was. It's designed to run Windows, right? So some of the components on it don't really have drivers for Linux, right? So there's a RAID controller in it, which is not really, the drivers are not good for Linux. But you just disable that, right? And then you just use it like a normal computer. And the lights out management stuff is more Windows orientated as well. So that stuff can just be ignored, actually. And, you know, maybe if they took that out, they could knock £20 off the price. I don't know. But when you're trying to run Linux on it, as I was going to do, it seems pretty well supported. I installed Ubuntu server, no difficulty, apart from one issue, which was that when you come to put a 3 terabyte drive into this machine, it doesn't have a very modern firmware interface. It's just got a traditional BIOS. It doesn't have EFI like more modern computers, so it doesn't see drives beyond 2 gigabytes. So I had to do a little bit of clever partitioning to get my 3 terabyte drive bootable from that machine. But that was the only kind of like super hardcore Linux thing that I had to do to get it running. But basically what I did was I split the disk into 800 gigs for the boot partition and the remaining 2.2 or so terabytes just for my Plex stuff. So it's all running off one disk at the moment. But the next logical step is probably to put in another disk and arrange some mirroring or something to just make sure that we're protected against a single disk failure as well.
Yeah, because that can always happen.
Yeah, that could happen in a week. You know, that's the thing. So, you know, one of the things that I realized, Bradley, when I was setting this up was just how long it had been since I had done a bare metal Linux install on a computer. I mean, it must have been, I'm trying to think, the last time I did a bare install of Linux must have been about 2004. And surprisingly little has changed, to be honest with you. Apart from that issue with the 3 terabyte disk, I mean, disks have gone over that boundary where it's difficult to deal with under BIOS. But beyond that, it was pretty straightforward, and I set it up. It was going to be headless, so I set it up without any of the user interface stuff that you normally get with Ubuntu. Just set it up as a kind of SSH server. And then from there, once I had finished that part, got SSH up and running, then the rest of it was just, you know, logging in from prompt on my iPad and just doing the rest of the sysadmin stuff.
Yeah, and so like if that kind of stuff like does, you're like SSHing in the servers, if you don't want to deal with that, that's where you may want to go with more of an option that's more geared to easy to set up. Again, you could run Windows on this server as well. It would probably be much easier to set up.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the Plex administration, if I was not confident about Linux sysadmin, I would seriously consider putting Windows on that and running the Windows version of Plex, or thinking about maybe getting a new Mac Mini or something. Okay, the new Mac Mini is going to be, you know, maybe double the price of that once you can get it going, but it's going to be a lot more straightforward. You know, you're talking about a double click install to run, get the server up and running. So that's, you know, I suppose it's the knowledge of Linux that makes it possible to get it for £300 instead of having to pay for a Mac or a PC Windows license as well.
So talk about how you migrated your data over from the old server to the new one.
Yeah, so that was, once you get Plex installed, right, it's basically what you do is you put a new source into the package manager on Linux and you just say, hey, install Plex, and it installs. You know, it's two command lines to get that done. But the data restore turned out to be the hard bit, okay? Now remember, my hard drive blew up, right? So all I've got is 1.2 odd terabytes up in Backblaze. And I've got a few things in Google Drive. I had a full archive of the West Wing on my Google Drive just because I hadn't quite finished taking it off and putting it somewhere else. But this was by far the hardest bit. You know, buying the server was easy. Even setting up the server was easy. But getting my data back from somewhere else on the internet was really pretty difficult. And the reason why was because primarily it's because Backblaze have this 30-day retention policy on disks, right? So the way that works is, if you say you have like a Mac Mini with a hard drive attached and you're backing it all up through Backblaze, Backblaze will see both the internal and the external hard drive. But what will happen is if, say, the external hard drive goes away, Backblaze will wait 30 days. And if it doesn't see that hard drive again within 30 days, it'll delete the backup. Right? Because I think there was some talk on ATP about this exact issue, maybe this week or last week. And one of the reasons, I suppose, is that they don't want people to like plug in 20 hard drives, archive them all, and then never really actively use those again. So it's not a data archival system. It's a live backup system. So the problem I had got was it took me like 20 days after the disk blew up to get the server up and running properly, mostly because I kind of dragged my feet on doing something about it. So I had maybe like 8 or 9 days left to get all this data back, and it was just proving impossible to get like the entire thing back by a free download from Backblaze. So what Backblaze will let you do is they'll let you choose a bunch of files, zip them, and download them. And that's great if you've got like a folder of Keynote files that you want to get back. That'll take 20 minutes, right? But if you've got hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes of video, first of all, it takes a long time for them to prepare your download to start with. And then they really don't like to make a zip file that's more than 20 gigabytes. And of course, I had, you know, hundreds of 20 gigabytes to get back. I was sort of going through this, you know, file tree going, okay, this TV show, season one, right, restore that. Start again. This TV show, season two, restore that. Can you imagine how long this is going to take, you know? So I managed to get all my kids' movies back, right? And that was okay, but it took me like 2 days to get all that done. So I was just like, there's no way I'm getting this done in time for to beat this deletion. So at the end of the day, what I did was I ponied up some money and asked Backblaze to send me a hard drive. And that's what they are doing right now.
Yeah, and how much was the hard drive restore?
I think it was $185.
Well, and because you were really in a pickle because you were going to lose your data if you didn't get it restored soon.
Yeah.
So it's not even like you were just impatient.
No, because I didn't really, I mean, I can wait to watch The West Wing again, right? But it was more like, I don't really want to have to, I mean, I could probably have recreated all that data from DVDs, but A, I didn't want to spend the time. Like, what's my? I was sitting there clicking these buttons, thinking, how much is my time worth here? You know. And the nice thing about Backblaze, right, is they're not trying to kind of screw you over, right? Because what you can do is you pay them that money, they will send you a hard drive with your data on it, and then you can send the hard drive back to them for a refund, right? So it's not. I mean, for me, that's going to be. I'm debating whether to do that or not because I've got to ship it back to America. But if you are in the States, for example, it's going to be no bother. But I mean, once the drive is ready, they put it on like a 2-day FedEx plane. So it shipped yesterday, it'll be here tomorrow. And hurricanes notwithstanding, hopefully that'll be me back with my data.
Yeah, so that can mean you have to kind of weigh what's the cost to return that drive. Yeah. But again, this just shows they're obviously a very fair company. They're allowing you to do that. So you'll see, theoretically, get this drive in, and you'll move all your data back, and then you're good to go.
Yeah, what I don't know is what format, what file system is going to be on that drive. Obviously, I was backing up a Mac, so it was an HFS Plus disk that I was uploading, but whether or not Backblaze actually care about that, I don't know. Maybe it's going to be on a Windows. You know, it might actually be better if it is on a Windows drive, because then I can probably mount it directly on the Linux machine and just copy the data over USB rather than having to do something with like an old Mac laptop and blah blah blah. But I mean, there are HFS utilities on Linux as well, so maybe I could do it either way, but we'll see how that goes.
Well, yeah, so what are your you know, long-term fears for this?
Well, I think I got to maybe do a better job of protecting myself against this happening again. So number one, maybe some on-site mirroring or something, put another drive in that enclosure and see what's what. But the other option is, you know, maybe I go for cloud backup again, but I do it in a way that I know is easier to restore back to a Linux machine. So Amazon S3 always springs to mind when you think about online file storage. Because the thing about video, right, which is different from, say, like backing up your iPad or your Mac, is that these files are never changing. Right, so once you've ripped the West Wing, you've got those 155 files there. They're not going to change. You're not going to edit 10 bytes in the middle of those files. So it's essentially like a cold storage situation. Amazon S3 is probably going to be about $25 a month to store the amount of stuff that I've got. But word of warning, Bradley, I don't know if you know about Amazon Glacier. Have you heard of that?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Do not store anything on Amazon Glacier, because if you ever want it back, you are going to be charged an absolute fortune to do that. The Amazon Glacier really financially penalizes you for ever trying to restore your data. And if you have, basically what it is you get a certain free amount of restored data from Glacier, but it's like a small amount per day. So if you upload, say you upload, what I did was I uploaded a zip of one season of The West Wing, and that was like, I don't know what it was, maybe 10 or 15 gigabytes. That was more than Amazon Glacier will let you restore for free in a single day. So if you just go on the console and go download that file, it's going to be like, there's going to be quite substantial charges for you to get that amount of data back in one go. So you got to be very, very careful about the cost of restoring your data from Amazon Glacier. It can get very high very quickly. What they really want you to do is trickle it back over a very long time. So Glacier is out, but you know, standard S3 could work, but it's going to be about $25. But Backblaze themselves, you know, this is starting to sound like a commercial for Backblaze, but anyone who saves your data is going to make you pretty happy. Backblaze have this thing called B2, which is a kind of, it's like their business product. And it's, whereas the consumer backup service is $5 per month, flat rate for however much data, B2 is charged per gigabyte month. But looking at, I just did a quick calculation there, and for the same amount of data, that would be $25 on Amazon S3, it's going to be $6 on Backblaze B2. So I'm thinking I'm going to have a, you know, good hard look at them and see what they can offer.
Well, and the overall thing you have to think about all these things is, like, going back to Amazon Glacier, it might be cheaper to, like, literally rebuy it than it would be to download it from Glacier. And so that's the thing you have to think about is, I mean, like, even if you're spending $25 a month backing up, it's like, how long are you at the point where you could have, like, just saved that money and rebought, like, kind of insured yourself to rebuy all your media if you need it? Or do you still have the physical copies of this that you could just, like, re-rip? I mean, that's the thing you have to wade through.
You've also got to factor into that calculation your time and re-ripping as well. I mean, I recently re-ripped my entire collection of The West Wing. I've got the DVD box set, and that took me basically a week to do that, of, you know, babysitting the drives in and out of the DVD drive and things like that. Took me about a week of time as well, to on and off, not like, you know, not 9 to 5, 5 days a week, but, you know, in between all my regular work, took me about a week to get all of those ripped. And, you know, is that a good use of your time as well? I'm not sure. So you got to factor in all those things. But I was already paying $5 a month for Backblaze anyway, so $6 for B2, you know, probably not a big difference, you know. I mentioned, Bradley, that I had some stuff on Google Drive. It turned out that was incredibly difficult to get back, right? I had a whole archive of The West Wing on Google Drive, and in order to download something of that size from Google Drive, what it wants to do is it wants to zip the whole thing up, but then if the zips turn out to be large, it will then split it into multiple zips. But this is where it gets weird, right? If you had a, say there's a folder of 22 episodes for one season, if you say download that folder, it will zip it into 6 zip files, each of which has got like 3 random files in it. So it's like, oh, where, what is this file? Why? And they've all got like the same name with a timestamp on the end. So it got really confusing and very manual in order to kind of get all those files back. So I think I'm going to get them down once and maybe not put them back in Google Drive again. So I wouldn't recommend Google Drive as a great archive. The other problem with that was also that there's absolutely no way to get to your Google Drive files from Linux. It's just a non-issue. It just can't even happen. So I was kind of doing it through downloading it to a Mac and then uploading it to the Plex server, and, you know, suddenly you're just like the data janitor, and it just seems to take forever.
Yeah, it sounds like a big bag of hurt. Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. The data stuff was by far the hardest. You know, the hardware, the software, all that stuff, no bother. But the data was a huge pain.
Well, anything we missed from your Plex adventure?
That's the main thing, and I think we've kind of covered all the bases. And these are still, you know, if you're doing it for home or if you're doing it for school, these are, you know, many of the things you're going to want to think about. And particularly in school, if you're convincing people to, you know, rip all their curriculum materials off of optical discs and get rid of them, you better make sure you're looking after that stuff, because if you're not, then you're going to have a problem. Yeah, it'd be interesting to think a wee bit more about how Plex might have an application in school as well as at home. But it's a super system, and I can't recommend all highly enough, despite my own carelessness with the data.
Again, we'll have links to the show notes to information about Plex and the various Plex apps and options as well. Thanks to our sponsors for tonight, Patreon. You know, you the listeners through Patreon and Jamf as well. And coming up on our next episode, I'm going to kind of quiz Fraser on some future of his school network infrastructure, and we'll see if he thinks he's making the right decision as he kind of rethinks some strategy. So you can check us out at outofschool.net. Fraser, any parting thoughts?
No, I think I've given you all the thoughts I have, but I'm really looking forward to the next show. I think it's going to be fun.
Yeah, well, so, you know, thanks everybody for subscribing. Please tell your friends. You can find us on Apple Podcasts at it's itunes.com/out of school, or you can just search for Out of School in any major podcasting application. You should find it. But again, always thanks for your reviews, thanks for your emails, and thanks for your kind words. And hope everybody has a fantastic week.